afternoon and welcome to Living Permaculture on KDNK. I'm Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, joined by my co-host Jerome Ossentowski of Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute in Basalt, Colorado. Today we're interviewing a local in our community, Dr. James Skeets of Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Dr. Skeets is a retired neurosurgeon and is now a permaculture homesteader. Dr. Skeets' wife, Julie Peterson, is still working in the medical field and contributes to the homestead by making fresh cheese and yogurt from their goats. We hope to inspire our listeners by learning about Dr. Skeets' journey to permaculture design and growing his own food. Dr. Skeets, welcome to the program, and may I call you Jim?
Please.
Well, can you tell us about your discovery of permaculture design, and was it something you pursued right away or kept in the back of your mind?
I kept it in the back of my mind. I think it started off back in the early 2000s when I was concerned about the future with in a declining energy future, and when I realized that in our current agricultural system, it takes 10 calories of petroleum to produce 1 calorie of food for most people, and it seemed very logical to start trying to produce some of your own food.
And did you grow up gardening or farming or anything like that?
No, ranching. Mm-hmm. So I worked on a ranch that ran about 950 head of Santa Gertrudis. And I later in college, I drove pea and wheat combines in the summer, but didn't do any much gardening at all until I later in life.
And where was that ranching? And
Southern Colorado, okay. About 40 miles south of La Junta.
Mm-hmm. When you moved to Glenwood Springs, did you select your property based on its food growing potential, or did you adapt it afterwards?
What I wanted was a place that has water, and since the Roaring Fork runs through my backyard, it has water. And it looked like it had the opportunity to grow quite a bit of stuff, so I've been putting in more and more hugelkultur beds and raised beds and started building greenhouses and that sort of thing.
Nice. Well, for our listeners' sake, can you take us through a virtual audio tour of your homestead?
Yes. Well, the first building I put up was the chicken coop. And since our primary problem in the area is bears and raccoons, I made it sort of a compound. So it's surrounded in chain link fence, buried 18 inches with electric fence around that, and has a top just to keep the raptors out because we have so many bald eagles and golden eagles and that sort of thing. And that's been very effective. So that was the first thing I put up, and now that's been modified. Jerome helped me overcome my fear of colony rabbits. And now, so I've been raising rabbits for, I guess, 3 years now, too. Mostly in cages before, but Jerome helped me get started in the colony, and now I have a lot of little bunnies, and that's working out really well. And it's surprising that the chickens and the rabbits get along really well. So that was my first building. We put up a geodome and got started on that, and then I read about Jerome's idea with the climate battery for one of his books, and that's how I got involved with Crimpy and took a couple of classes there. And that's been very helpful to have that geodome, and then built a second greenhouse and then put in a root cellar. And then I've got 5 hugelkultur beds and 15 raised beds, and so I've been kind of going from there.
And you have a forest garden as well?
Yes, I've been planting lots of fruit trees, and there were a couple of apple trees there to begin with, and those are older trees but still quite productive. So I canned, like this year, I canned 5 cases of applesauce.
Yeah, canned. You plant grapes along your fence lines?
Yep, grapes along the fence line.
I liked it that you brought in these big stock tanks and used those as your raised bed containers.
Right. My ground is really quite rocky. And so I've tried to do it both ways and to utilize as much of it as possible. And it is quite a bit of work to build hugelkultur beds. The way I've been doing it is taking my backhoe, trenching it out, and then I'll start with wood chips and then a layer of dirt and then chicken coop cleanings and then another layer of dirt and then alternating organic material and dirt, you know, with my goat yards, I can get good mixtures of straw and goat manure.
And they're a nice height. And I use pallets instead of, because I get them for free, and I build all my beds that way in the greenhouse and also outside now. But I like a high bed so you can throw all that organic matter in there.
Right.
And the worms, and you just keep
right
building, and you always have room to, because it keeps settling, so you always have room to put more material in, and then you can sit along the outside, and
it's easier. The less young one becomes, not having to get down on the ground as much is quite a bit better,
and
they do. There is a considerable amount of subsidence. That when I raised my raised beds in those stock tanks, what I did is I put about 4 or 5 inches of gravel down, and then I put landscape cloth. I took out the plug so that it'll drain properly, and then just kind of made it like a typical hugelkultur bed. And in the first year, you get quite a bit of subsidence, and then after that, it's nice. It's kind of like no-till gardening. You just keep adding more
mulching,
organic material, and then a little bit of mulch to protect the soil. And the worms, you know, I gather worms when I'm making a bed and just put them in there. And
you know, you brought me in to help you fix a few things on your dome, and we got through that, and the dome, you know, does work. I think your other greenhouse is much bigger and more expansive. So, and you you came up with a pretty good design for that. I think it just gives you a lot of a big season extender that you built from wood and panels.
Right. Yeah. So my other larger greenhouse is really quite helpful because it does extend the season, and then I can grow a lot of things which I like to eat that are hard to grow around here without it, like sweet potatoes, and so that's just hard to grow here without.
And you had a big patch of basil in there that I kept stealing from you when I come
over.
I
seem to be able to grow quite a bit of basil. I still have like 20 cans of or jars of basil in my freezer.
And you know, the fact that you and your wife do all this value added, all this preparation, plus you have the root cellar, which is, you know, I don't know if there's anybody who's ever recently gone out in their front yard and dug a root cellar. Of course, maybe
it's amazing.
Did you get a permit to do that?
One of the nice things about our county is that you don't have to have building permits for agricultural buildings.
Right.
And all of the buildings I put up are agricultural.
Exactly.
And so they, you know, I haven't required a permit. And the root cellar is really, you've been in it. Yeah. So it's just such a useful thing. And I think a lot of people don't appreciate or they don't look to what things are going to be like in an energy-constrained future.
Mm.
So, you know, as I mentioned, you know, the 10 calories of petroleum to put 1 calorie of food on your plate. In a energy-constrained future where all sorts of things, you know, natural gas or electricity are much more expensive, having something as old-fashioned as a root cellar is really helpful. I mean, just to be able to... I'm going to give you both some carrots and squash and potatoes that I took out of my root cellar this afternoon.
And you also grow parsnips. You say you have a whole bunch in the ground that you're going to winter over. And I remember back in 77, 78, if you can remember that far back.
Not me.
Before I even got into gardening, I would go to Grand Junction to a carrot farmer, and he grew daikons and beets and turnips. And I would buy bushels of carrots, and I would trench them in the front yard of my. That was before I even did any agriculture. So that was the old time way of doing it. You dig about a foot and a half trench, or maybe just a foot, and then you put the carrots in there and you cover it up with about 6 inches of soil, and then the snow would come on and you would just take a gunny sack full of leaves and stick it at one end with a stick mm-hmm. there so you could find it. And then you just dug it up as you needed it. You'd go in and get a bucket.
Right. Well, that's definitely a technique that they did that a lot in Europe as well. It's just that it's a lot easier to get the stuff out of the root cellar.
Exactly.
And I can keep my eggs down there and the potatoes, and it's really easy to just go in and out, and it keeps them fresh. What I do for my carrots is I just have bins or sacks of sand, moist sand, and you just put the carrot in the moist sand, and it keeps them from dehydrating, and they really keep well. It's also the same thing. I have cabbages left over. The trick for the cabbage is what you do is you take all the lower leaves off, so you just have the head on the root stalk, mm-hmm. and then you just put that in wet sand too, and it just keeps the cabbage from dehydrating. Yeah. Works really well.
And what other types of preserves do you have in there other than the applesauce?
What are the things that I've canned? Salsa. I did 5 cases of salsa, 12 jars per case. And
sauerkraut?
Oh, yeah. I do make sauerkraut from my cabbage. Mm-hmm. I almost always have sauerkraut going.
And that makes everything clear through you, right?
Well, it keeps that gut biome healthy. Exactly. Between that and homemade goat yogurt, all those good lactobacilli in there. Right.
Can you tell us more about Julie's yogurt and cheese making?
Well, so the yogurt, when we started that, you go to the grocery store and then buy some organic yogurt and then use that as your starter. And afterwards, it's actually pretty, it's quite simple. You just take your milk and you do kind of pasteurize that. You get up to 185 and then you cool it down to 115, then take some of your, like 3/4 cup of your old yogurt, mix it with some of the milk, and then just stir it up real well. And I use my dehydrator. You want to keep it at about 115 degrees for like 20 to 24 hours. And then it comes out a really good yogurt.
And then you just put it in the refrigerator. Right?
After that, I put it in the refrigerator. Yeah. But yeah, so you just my dehydrator works really well as a way to keep it at 115 degrees in a nice steady temperature.
And I just, I'm starting to do some more value added at my place because I'm thinking if I go to the store, all the things that I buy at the store, what if I didn't have to buy that? And just recently, mm-hmm. I have sauerkraut because Sarah came over and did a whole bunch of sauerkraut and took a whole bunch with her. She did jams as mm-hmm. well. And I have 3 electric dryers, so I don't have to buy dried fruit anymore because mm-hmm. I used to buy a lot of dried fruit. So I have pears and apples and bananas and pineapple and tomatoes. Mm-hmm. So right now I've got tomatoes and so I buy the overripe organic bananas and just,
slice them up.
I freeze them and use them in smoothies, but if I'm not doing that, I'll dry them. So you have all this extra fruit and I still have about 5 bushels of apples I need to dry in my refrigerators from Paonia. So, and I'm just checking all those things off. So when I go to the store, I don't need to buy those things anymore.
I totally agree. I try to make that, and I grew the peppers, I grew the onions, I grew the garlic,
and tomatoes.
It's just, and then just can it, and canning is so easy.
It is, yeah.
It's just not a difficult thing. I have a canner. I can do 7 quarts at a time.
Oh, nice.
And so I think I canned 35 quarts of beans, green beans.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you invested in some equipment that makes it real easy for you. Like.
Right. I mean, it's like for apples.
Right.
If you don't have one of those peelers, I'll have to get you one.
Those are amazing.
I think I want to get one because, I'm just hacking it up and the skins are there.
Because especially if you're making applesauce and you're canning applesauce, you don't want to do it with the skins on.
Yeah.
It's much easier to, and this cores it. And you can feed all that stuff to the goats and the chickens.
Exactly.
And it's like my all of the fallen apples that were wormy, I gathered all those up and left them in the back of my pickup, and then would take out a bucket every other day and give it to the chickens and rabbits, and they finished all of them off. I mean, in the past, I'd taken the bad apples to sustainable settings, and they'd feed them to their pigs, but it's like, I got enough little critters.
The goats love them, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
So, Jim, what are some of the ways you close the input and output loops with your livestock and garden?
Well, all of the manure from both the rabbits and the goats gets recycled, you know, goes back in the beds. And it's one of the things to really have a good sustainable system, you have to have herbivores. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just really important to have herbivores around to generate that really high quality manure, which is so good for your soil bacteria.
And really good high quality meat. And they recycle a lot of material that you wouldn't have to buy.
Right.
I do all that chop and drop. That's why I feed my rabbits and chickens. Chickens are very good recyclers. I don't have any right now. The bears ate them all, but I'm looking for a few chickens and maybe pigs even.
I've thought about pigs too. Probably, from my idea, it's just getting a single one pig as a feeder pig, get it in the spring and then process it in the fall.
Yeah.
So, one of the things that makes it possible for me to do what I'm doing, where I'm doing it, is having my dogs. I have two Anatolian Shepherds, and everyone on my street just had a terrible problem with bears this year, and I just don't have any problem with that at all because the dogs keep the bears out.
And you promised to give me a couple of the pups.
Yes.
I'm tired of fighting the bears after 30, 40 years of fighting the bears. I want to have a dog finally.
Well, I'll tell you, they're just so good at that. They it's a 3,000-year-old breed that keeps the wolves away in Turkey. So, and there's so much of the things that when you, if you're harvesting your goat or your chickens or your rabbits, that all goes to the dogs and they take care of it. So that's when, kind of the process of keeping things in. And like in the springtime, I mean, I have a lot of dandelions in my yard, and so the first thing I do is go out in the morning before I go out to the chickens and start digging up a big mess of dandelions to take out there, and they love them. So that's one of the things I try to dig up and get to my critters too.
And do you feel like managing your homestead is a full-time job/hobby?
Yes. It's just absolutely it's okay, but it's very fulfilling.
Right. It's a way of life.
Yeah.
Do you think there's any parallel between neurosurgery and homesteading and permaculture?
No. And now for something completely different.
Good. Yeah. So you're getting balance in your life.
Yes.
But what I've noticed when I go to your front gate and I look over across the way and there's all the houses in your neighborhood have lawns, right? And I remember when I would go to the Pow Pow Fest in Fredericks, Maryland. I didn't go this year, but two previous years, I would stay with Andy and Emily Roy, and they turned their front yard and their backyard into forest garden. Mm. And it was in a suburban neighborhood, just like yours, with lawns everywhere. And I recorded a show, and we played it on KD&K. This was about 4 years ago. And I remember asking him, what made you do this with all these lawns all around? Weren't you kind of, wasn't it kind of awkward to do that? And he said, well, somebody has to be the first guy on the dance floor. That was his answer. And so, but you had other motivations. You wanted to grow good food, and you have... what's your dietary preference then?
I generally eat a paleo diet.
Uh-huh.
So I eat meat and then lots of vegetables and really avoid much grain.
Yeah.
I just
don't. And it's all there, right?
It's all there.
Every day you go down and get something.
And Jim, you have at least one adult child, is that right?
I have three.
Three, okay. And do you feel like you've influenced their diet and food growing at all? Or?
Well, actually, my elder son is the one who started me on the paleo diet.
Okay.
And my younger son he'll eat just about anything. And mm-hmm. My daughter doesn't really care.
Oh. But have they come to visit your homestead?
Oh, yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah, everybody enjoys that. And I hope that in the long run, you know, part of the way that I build things when I put up a new building is I really want it to have a 50-year design life so that it isn't going to fall apart, and it's actually the idea is so in the future they'll be able to have it for the next generation.
Amazing. So. Have you been influenced by any print or digital books or resources?
Yes. You know, I think the first book that I read to start getting into gardening was called Gardening When It Counts by Steve Solomon. Very good book. And his second book called The Intelligent Gardener is really quite good and has a lot of discussion about the issues with gardening on a local basis where you're getting all of your food from a local standpoint. And then some of the other kinds of things I've researched in the past, which people don't necessarily appreciate, and that's things like, especially in the South or Mesoamerica, where people have a predominantly corn-based diet, and what you have to do to make that safe, because people, when Europeans took over growing corn, they didn't understand the process of nixtamalization, and it causes pellagra.
I've never heard of either of those things.
Okay, so it's why if you go to the Mexican places, they sell masa rather than cornmeal, and that's because it's gone through the process of nixtamalization where you boil it with lime, and if you don't do that, you will get pellagra. And that's why when you buy flour in the U.S., it all says it's enriched because they're adding the vitamins.
Oh, I see.
For that. And these are the kinds of things if you people aren't aware of in our diets, and that say things were to become less centralized, and those kinds of things didn't happen, there are significant dietary problems that people will come into. And that's, you know, those are nice things to make people aware of.
So are there ancient strains of corn?
Well, you know, corn originally comes from Mesoamerica, and, you know, they were pretty small heads initially. I mean, the corn that I grow is from Montana. It's called Painted Mountain because it is a shorter season, so it comes, it's easier to mature.
Is it sweet corn?
No, it's Indian corn.
Indian corn, yeah.
So, you know, it's lots of different colors. I like it, and personally, I like to eat it because it really tastes like a nutty flavor rather than sugary. It's more of a nutty flavor. But you could also, it can be ground up, and I feed it to my chickens, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of these dietary things that have fallen out of favor is sauerkraut and kimchi. Oh. If I don't have that in my diet, my body doesn't work.
What about your miso, your 40-year-old miso?
Well, that too, miso and any kind of fermented foods, right? In fact, I got that out the other day and gave some to Sarah. And we may make some.
You should give some to Jim.
Okay, yeah. I'll give you some my 40-year-old miso. We might do a barrel next year. I think it's a little too late now, but... I really would like to do more. I'm going to team up with Sarah Hay, who lives over in Sustainable Settings and farms over there. But she's willing to work with me on some value-added projects.
I totally agree because I have sauerkraut every lunch.
Yeah, every day.
Every day.
Yeah.
And I'll usually have yogurt too. Yogurt with blueberries.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean it's just. You know, the good antioxidant qualities. And then I usually try to have some of my homegrown chicken eggs with onions, which I usually grow myself. The one thing I haven't done myself, which I probably should learn, is mushrooms, because the combination of actually onions and mushrooms is very synergistic.
Well, we'll need to get you some logs, because we buried those cottonwood logs about 3 years ago, and we even had a flush this year. Of golden oysters, You'll have to find the cottonwood logs, though. But you can find somebody who's cutting down a cottonwood tree right in your street there.
Yeah.
And have them just drop off the rounds at your gate, and we'll bury them halfway and inoculate them. That's just another thing you don't have to buy.
Yeah.
Well, as I mentioned to you earlier in the year, your site would be a perfect place to host a fruit tree pruning workshop. So if you're still up for that, I'll reach out to you in late winter so that we can arrange that. And do you have any social media handles our listeners could possibly follow you on?
I'm sorry, I don't have any social media. All of my friends use my phone.
Right, good.
Right. That's a good way to be under the radar. Huh?
That's right. And do you have any last reflections or topics or parts of your background you wanted to share more or to inspire our listeners?
It only takes one step to start a journey.
There you go.
Exactly. And somebody has to be the first one on the dance floor.
Yes. I really do wish, I will have a parting comment. I think that everybody in grade school should have the opportunity to learn how to plant things and start learning how to garden. I think that should be a grade school. And another thing that I really wish they hadn't taken out of junior high schools, which I know when I was in seventh grade, we had wood shop as a mandatory class, and then metal shop was a mandatory class in eighth grade. And it's just such a disservice to all the kids to not be able to take those kinds of shop classes and learn how to do things with their own hands.
Mm-hmm.
That's just—it's really important to be able to build things on your own and
fix things.
And yeah,
build some salvage.
Learning how to do things with your hands is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get into permaculture, you'll need to do that.
Yeah. That's right. Well, Jim, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule homesteading to share your experiences with our listeners.
Thank you for inviting me.
Our pleasure. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today. I'm your host, Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, and my co-host is Jerome Osentowski of Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute in Basalt, Colorado. And if you stay tuned about our fruit tree pruning schedule that'll occur in late winter, early spring, maybe you'll get a chance to see Jim's homestead yourself. Tune in next month on the third Monday of the month at 4 p.m. for another episode of Living Permaculture. We'll talk to you then.